Hello and welcome to USSOcast, a US Studies online podcast. This is the second episode in a new series in which I chat to PhDs and early career researchers about their work, their life in academia, and all things in between. Today, I'm joined by Danielle Cameron, a PhD student at University of East Anglia, who is working on age, space, and narrative in post-1970 American literature. So firstly, Danielle, welcome. How are you?
Hello, I'm good, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on. Do you just want to tell us, well, in as much detail as you like, really, what your research entails, your PhD?
Sure thing. So just for context about where I am at in the project, I'm in the middle of my second year. So I currently feel like there's a lot of moving parts and I'm trying to just pin them down. But
the dreaded second year.
I've heard about it and now I'm in it. So, my working title is Aging, Power and Narrative in Post-1970 American Literature. And at the center of this, I'm interested at how age and aging is narrated in novels by authors such as Colson Whitehead, Jennifer Egan, Don DeLillo and Paul Auster. And how does a character's age affect how they view themselves, how they view other characters, and how they interact with the spaces that they encounter through these narratives. And by doing this, I'm hoping to challenge the ways in which age continues to pass as this kind of invisible apolitical identity aspect. Because ultimately, once you start looking for age, age is everywhere in literature. Each novel is narrated by a character at a certain age. How does this affect their access and ability to wield socio-political power in the novel that you're reading? And so also at the center of this, I'm challenging the normativity of adulthood as this kind of aspirational, seemingly all-powerful stage, and situating age in literature as part of an intersectional identity. So ultimately age intersects with gender, race, class. And so ultimately, once we age out of childhood, or a character ages out of childhood, how does that affect their trajectory in the novels that we read, if that makes sense?
No, that sounds so interesting. I've got a lot of questions that I want to kind of get to, because I've read a few of the authors you've named, but not loads, and I know kind of very little about them, which is why it's great to talk to you. Is this a project that was born from an MA project, or I mean, how did you first come to this as a topic? Because it's really interesting and not really like anything I've come across as yet, which is great. So how did you first come to it?
So I think the moment it came to the front of my mind was akin to an identity crisis in my MA. So I read for an MA in American literature at UEA, where I'm completing my PhD, and I've also completed an MPhil in education at Cambridge, which focused on children's literature and the kind of theory and study of children's literature as a separate but related discipline. So in the middle of my MA in American literature, which I did prior to the education in MPhil, I realized all the research I've done, my undergraduate dissertation, my MA dissertation, I'm looking at youth, and I thought, what is this? Why? Like, I hadn't purposely gone for that, but I realized I'm fascinated by the way youth is situated in literature, and by proxy, how it's situated in American kind of cultural studies. And I thought, crikey, should I be studying children's literature? What does this mean for my research? And fortunately, I was in a position to pursue that MPhil, which gave me training in like methodological training in researching children's literature and aspects of childhood studies that just hadn't been covered in my previous undergrad or MA, which were all literature focused. So it was kind of, my PhD is born out of a blending of those two things, because by studying children's literature and childhood studies, I became privy to this kind of narratological toolkit about talking about age, and specifically youth, of course, that was the focus of that degree. Mm-hmm. But I just suddenly thought, why aren't these terms that seem to be so specific to childhood studies and children's literature, why aren't we talking about them in relation to literature written for adults? And my central one to my project is looking at eto-normativity, which is the normativity of adulthood. How and why has adulthood become the norm for basic literary narratives? And ultimately, therefore, childhood and also old age is othered. So it was through my MPhil that I became aware of that. And I suddenly thought, why aren't we like turning this focus onto literature for adults and kind of asking, why aren't we talking about age in literature for adults? Because once you go into childhood studies, age and the discussion of age is so central to that. But then when we move out of specifically children's literature to the literature that me and you probably went through in undergrad. It's like we don't talk about it. So my project was born out of that, why don't we, and what can we gain by shifting that focus. So I'm trying to marry a critical vocabulary to texts that just hadn't encountered those before.
Yeah, it's so interesting how it moved from children's lit through to adulthood. And then, you know, you talk about kind of old age being othered as well. I know from my own kind of just not research, but my own interests in American lit in particular, like coming of age narratives were something I anchored, you know, to really early on in kind of my teenage years. Obviously, you know, you're going through the same things the characters are going through, the protagonists are going through. So there's that relatability there. But yeah, I just love the way that it kind of expanded from an MA project on children's lit. I mean, was coming of age linked with that, or was coming of age something that kind of came afterwards a little bit, and just as you started thinking of one age bracket and then suddenly you had multiple?
Actually the MA projects, I'll walk you through my undergrad diss and then my MA project, because actually coming of age was much more central to my undergrad dissertation.
Oh wow, okay, so it's kind of like a retrofit. I like that.
A little bit, yeah. Because ultimately my undergrad dissertation was what opened my eyes up to thinking, yes, I definitely want to do an MA. This is what I want to do. So my undergrad dissertation was actually looking at coming of age and Carrie, and we need to talk about Kevin.
Oh, wow.
And looking at how coming of age and horror intersect, and the figure of the horrifying adolescent as this figure that's been present in American literature and culture for at least 40 years, but has progressed from the supernatural to the naturalistic. That was the center of that argument. And then my MA was actually looking at the portrayal of children in Don DeLillo, and in the portrayal of children in different spaces in Don DeLillo's works. So tracing romanticized child, like the romanticized child of White Noise, for instance, to the infantilized adult woman in Point Omega. And that was how I traced it. And it was in the middle of that MA dissertation, I thought, I'm constantly writing about youth. What does this mean? I want to kind of delve deeper into this. And I my MA supervisor from UEA is actually currently my PhD supervisor too. So when I turned up and I said, I think I want to do another 1 year master's, and I think I want to do it in education to kind of just deepen that focus, deepen that knowledge of age. She was really supportive, and I was like, long game, I want to come back and do a PhD, and that's ultimately what I did. So coming of age was the kind of jumping off point, but I think also coming of age, like you, I gravitated towards coming of age throughout my teenage years.
Yeah,
I often do say this was like testament to my cohort back in MA studies. There are two books I think that bring people to the study of American literature, at least out of our class, because it was either Great Gatsby that you read like in secondary school.
Oh, I did that at A level, yeah.
Oh, Catcher in the Rye. Yeah. And mine was Catcher in the Rye because I am an emo at heart, and it really struck that with me. So I was like, Great Gatsby for the people that are less annoyed at life, Catcher in the Rye for the people that are a bit more angsty and annoyed. But that's what it seemed to be. And I that's what drew me into American literature. That book is probably the first one that opened my eyes to that study. Coming of age is been my springboard, but also been at the background of a lot of what I've done so far. But coincidentally, the chapter I'm currently working on is on coming of age narratives and how do we actually fit this into the lifespan, like how do we talk about the life course in literature. So yes, I'm looking at it as a genre, but also coming of age is ultimately about the approach of adulthood. So I'm also interested in seeing not just how these books, so I'm looking at Sag Harbor and The Invisible Circus, at Whitehead and Negan novels, and how do they not only talk about adolescent identity but like the inevitability of adulthood at the same time.
I'm really interested in the fact that you started with like horror and the monstrous adolescent, and then obviously you've gone so much it's expanded, I guess it's broader now, but those facets that you find in kind of horror literature, those kind of sudden eruptions of violence and kind of repression and things like that, are they still present in the text you look at now and they're still kind of simmering in the background? Or is that something that was an undergrad project and you've kind of moved on from now? Or do these things all kind of bleed into one?
They do bleed. And interestingly, I do have a chapter that's going to be focusing on horror aspects.
Okay, great.
Aging. Yeah. But actually the focus there will be on how Whitehead, Egan, and DeLillo to some extent use horror tropes and dystopian tropes to talk about the fear of aging. So it's less about the teenager this time, it's more just how do they use particularly dystopian settings to talk like crumbling cities, ruinous cities about, and how does that link with the characters' fear of change and ultimately that change manifesting as them either growing older or loved ones growing older. So it does all bleed.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to that chapter, because the further I go into this project, I do realize like horror studies was like my first love. And
that never truly leaves, does it?
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of like your primary material, I mean, as a host of a American Cities podcast, I probably shouldn't admit that I've actually not read any DeLillo up to this point, which is insane for me to admit. I've been meaning to get to White Noise for so long now, and I think it's the film rights have just been bought by someone. It's being made. I can't remember. Someone famous is turning it into.
Oh yeah, it's like.
Is it Noah Baumbach?
It's Baumbach. Yeah. I read the headline and I went, oh, that's surprising. And then I went, oh no, it's not. Oh, you think about it, you're like, oh no, it's not surprising. Noah Baumbach, Adam Driver, Greta Gerwig. I'm not one of the super hard DeLillo fans who's like, this cannot be filmed and it will be terrible. But I also am like,
you're
on
skeptical.
The fence. I don't know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah.
A little bit. But
I've read Timbuktu by Paul Auster, which does deal with aging in some ways. I mean, what Paul Auster books are you looking at in particular? Or you could talk about a few books in particular that you're looking at across your range of authors.
Sure thing. So with Auster in particular, I'm looking at The Brooklyn Follies and 4321, his epic.
Yes.
And the further I go into it, so I have four authors at the centre of this. But I ultimately am looking at more Whitehead and Egan, it seems, as I'm going further through the project. So for DeLillo and Auster, it's Brooklyn Follies 4321, like I mentioned, and then Falling Man and Zero K for DeLillo at the moment. Mm-hmm. Again, it's shifting parts. I'm bringing these four authors into dialogue because I think, for instance, I don't want to get into the murky waters of postmodernism too deep.
But please do.
But it's these are authors that I love first and foremost, but also when talking about bringing children's literature studies vocabulary into conversation with literature for adults.
Yeah.
If you think about the critical...
With a capital L.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you think about the critical discourse around postmodernism, no, these two like bodies of work aren't often brought together. Like children aren't often seen as key to these big postmodernist like magnum opus, I don't know, but it's so I was interested in bringing that into together. So yeah, those are my DeLillo and Auster. And also we're looking, by bringing these four authors together, you're also looking at two generations of authors that have differing relationships to postmodernism as well. So DeLillo and Auster being very much in the fold at the birth of that kind of movement of authors in America, whereas like Whitehead and Egan have a slightly more uneasy relationship with it. I find it fascinating that Whitehead, when he released his first book at the end of the 90s, The Intuitionist, he was being heralded as the next in line for like the postmodernist throne, and whereas Jennifer Egan, I presume because she's a woman, she's sometimes tangentially talked about as postmodern or post-postmodern, but she's never really held up as like that next in the genealogy of,
yeah, like the paragon of the new move.
It's interesting. But for them, for Whitehead, I'm looking at Colossus of New York, which is his collection of essays about New York and 13 different essays in 13 different places around the city, which I love. Sag Harbor, which is his coming of age novel, his most recent novel, The Nickel Boys, which came out 2 years ago. I'm still in 2020 mode.
It sounds about right, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. And Zone One, which is a zombie novel. And then for Egan, I'm looking at A Visit from the Goon Squad, which is probably her best known work. The Invisible Circus, a coming of age novel. Manhattan Beach, which is a historical novel about daughters and fathers in 1940s New York. Mm-hmm. And then finally, The Keep, which is her gothic, like riff on the gothic novel. So... Mm-hmm. A lot of moving parts, as you can see.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love that because I'm someone who uses a lot of primary material as well. I did a lot in my MA and my dissertation. This time around, there's a lot of primary material across photography, art, literature and stuff. So like you know, there's a lot of fingers and a lot of pies, I guess. One of the most striking aspects of your research, which I really wanted to ask you about today, is, as you've just intimated, you have a big focus on New York and the city in particular. So is there a certain valency that aging and power have in the city that they maybe don't have in rural America? Why the focus on kind of the urban? Because as someone who looks at the complete opposite to that, like small town America, there's a really nice departure here, which I'm interested in.
So the focus on the city is born out of me kind of perceiving it to be a nexus, like the density of the city brings these age relations and intergenerational kind of presentations into a real tight focus. Like they're coexisting next to each other much more closely than a narrative set in the rural. But I do think these series have application wider than the city. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just focusing my project, my background also is in, like, I've researched New York literature in the past as well.
Okay.
And it just was that, I want to say it's to focus my project, which is true, but it was also like a happy coincidence that these novelists that I do really love, they all return to New York quite regularly in their novels. For instance, when I read The Nickel Boys when it first came out, the majority of it is not set in New York, but it, like, I won't do any spoilers, but it ends up in New York. And yeah. I was just very happy with that. I was just like, of course he's coming back to New York. So my focus on the city is not to say that the study of age is most relevant to the city. I just think it like the city skews age relations in such an interesting way. And also interestingly, like the city is not seen as a place for youth, or at least for childhood. Of course, there's so many narratives about adolescents coming to the city mm-hmm. and young adults coming to the city, but actual infancy is not seen as a city state, and arguably also old age isn't. So again, this is like bringing into sharper relief what age actually means in terms of access to, like, your own kind of self-identity, your access to actually being able to move around environments and to engage with others. And so that's kind of how that happened. And interestingly, the chapter I'm working on, Coming of Age, is actually the only chapter where I'm not focusing on the city, or at least not New York, mm-hmm. because both The Invisible Circus and Sag Harbor have teenage protagonists at the center who grow up in cities. So Invisible Circus is San Francisco, and then Sag Harbor is New York, but they move out of the city, and the coming of age happens outside of the city by journeys outside of it. So I'm dealing with issues of mobility and memory in that chapter, in terms of how mobility informs characters' sense of impending age, and how and if they like that, and like how they deal with that independence.
Yeah, I mean, I could literally talk about this for hours, because there's so many intersections with the things I look at as well. I mean, a lot of the coming of age material that I read when I was younger, I mean, a lot of it was kind of pulpy Stephen King style stuff. They're often set in small towns. And then you have that, as you say, that kind of adolescent moment of going to the city. And I have a chapter on mobility and migration and that kind of thing. And one of the stock narratives is the adolescent departure from small towns to go to the city to kind of make a name for themselves. And it's that idea of, adulthood being this aspirational thing that can only be found in a city. It's interesting how it's kind of occurring in all these spaces at once. But I think using the city, and in particular New York, to focus your work is really effective, because although, you know, canons are very problematic, New York kind of exists and it's kind of paradigmatic in American lit. It's why so many of these big writers that you're looking at orbit New York, I guess.
I just like the term orbit New York. Like that is so what they do, especially even in their dystopian writings, which I approach in my final chapter. Is like, for instance, Oster uses dystopian city settings, but he doesn't necessarily name New York. But it's so, New York is so emblematic of his writing, and it doesn't need to be said, which I find interesting. But also another thing I want to say about my kind of approach to the city was, in that tight concentration, that high density of human narratives within the city, I also see in these novelists writing that this kind of high density, high concentration allows like the exaltation of youth and the anxiety of old age to play out more obviously, and by that happening in such an emblematic, like, figurehead American city, that makes the links between certain age stages and American kind of myth making and American anxieties as well much more apparent. And as I say it feels really big, but like I constantly have to like hone it in. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to access with the city at the moment.
No, I mean, it sounds big in the best possible way, I think. This is something I always worry about, that my own project is too expansive, and, you know, it's something we all deal with. But, you know, it sounds so great from this side listening in. I mean, my next question is about, you know, that honing in that you've just said. Are there any examples of any writers or even other media that you feel are basically perfect for your study and your research, but you've had to essentially kill your darlings and say, I can't look at you, I've already got too much primary material, because I've had to do this, we've all had to do it. I wonder if there's anything that you want to write about that you haven't had chance, or that, you know, you're saving up your sleeve for another project, maybe.
That's a good question. So I would say this only came to me last year, so it wasn't when I was like initially planning and applying for the project. Mm-hmm. But last year I read Severance, which I think everybody was reading in light of pandemic narratives. So I read Severance and I just thought, this is just crap, like cracking. And in terms and in terms of its treatment of adulthood and construction of adulthood, and the kind of the relationship between a character being able to sense their own adulthood, the relationship between their self-definition and financial means and work, and because the work culture in Severance, you're looking at the brief summaries, it's like you're looking at a character who found all her self-worth in working workaholic hours, because that's a work culture in New York. Mm-hmm. Then a pandemic hits and all the infrastructure, all the kind of normality as we've gone through, crumbles, but in a much more like depressing way than we're going through. And she loses work, and like she loses that self-definition, and it essentially infantilizes her. It causes her to kind of think of herself as less than, but then that kind of opens up avenues upon how we hinge our self-worth or like our understandings of adulthood upon being productive, or remaining within a work culture. So stuff like that. And also I'm currently reading Luster, Raven Lolani's Luster, and that's a New York based narrative, again written very recently, not a dystopian narrative, but we're looking at the main character, the way they talk about financial precarity. It's so linked to understandings of adulthood. She feels like she's becoming a child and she loses her means of income. So these are things that I'm like, yes, my project would become too big if I wanted to include this. So yeah. I think ultimately the avenue that I'm having to axe off a little bit is the relationship between financial kind of gain and adulthood. But that's something that may well come into my next chapter. My third chapter is looking at homemaking and the relationship between being able to purchase property, make homes, and construction of adulthood. So it might come into a little bit of that, but obviously those authors are outside of my remit at the moment. But Yeah.
It sounds like you've got a lot of ammunition for other projects, though, which is always good to have. You know, you always need these kind of things that jettison off, but, you know, you don't forget about them entirely. Kind of circling back, this is a bit of a tangent, but something you mentioned earlier was just really interesting to me that I wanted to kind of pick up on again. And you mentioned it with Paul Auster, the idea of describing a city like New York without kind of naming it specifically, the kind of intimation of place and that kind of thing. I mean, I think the first thing I've ever read by Auster was a section from Moon Palace where the narrator's like sleeping in Central Park or something. And it's the way the kind of city takes on a really otherworldly feel in that as well. And I was just wondering, is this something you notice across the age ranges you look at, the kind of slippage in reality of how real a city is? So in my head, I'm kind of imagining childhood and coming of age narrative. The city is this huge behemoth that they're trying to make sense of, and it's described in kind of dreamlike almost ways. Mm-hmm. When you reach, you know, ostensibly aspirational adulthood, it becomes really clear, and you know it's very clearly New York or a city like that's being described. And then again, when you get to old age, there's a regression, and the city kind of becomes a bit more amorphous again. Is that something that I've just pulled out of nowhere, or have you noticed that kind of change and shift in how real a place is?
I've noticed that, again, like this is so limited to my project, I don't want to make grand sweeping statements, but it's like I've noticed that in terms of the portrayal of very young children, so let's talk about prepubescent characters.
Yeah.
They kind of accept the city as it is. Mm. And it's an environment that they're in. They don't hero worship it. Like I think a lot of the adolescent, when you're talking about adolescent characters' attitudes to cities, in some respects I feel like that is the clearest the city is ever going to be. They arrive or they inhabit the city with kind of that myth of the city in their head. And I actually do think adulthood is the kind of realizing that myth isn't true. And I don't know whether that is clarity or whether it's like it's dissolution. I don't know. And with old age, again, I do think I like what you say about the dreamlike quality. I think when you're reaching end of middle age into old age, you do get this kind of spectral quality of the city. Like similarly to the very young children characters, they accept the city as it is, but they're but it's also kind of like it's faded.
Mm.
It's faded in its kind of vitality. Not in a like purely depressing way, but I think it's kind of the myths of
that loss of something. Yeah.
And again, I don't want to say it's a purely bad thing. I think it's just the aftermath of realizing the reality of the city in these novels, and realizing that actually you can, it, a place is what you make it.
Mm.
Whereas when it's like the adolescent approaching the city with bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, with all the energy, when those adolescent characters arrive, they're descended into kind of that myth falling apart a little bit. Again, I don't want to sound super depressing.
No, by all means do. All of my work is super depressing. But no, I think the grand myth structures of America falling apart through these different, you know, narratives, and, you know, the grand arrival of a city suddenly seeming not so grand at all. And, you know, that's a lot of stuff I look at as well. And I just think it is so true, all the things that you're identifying here. So, I mean, it's been great to talk about your research. And as I said, we could literally just do this all day. One of the formats we're doing in these episodes is kind of shifting in the kind of toward the end of the episode, just about your own experiences in academia. I mean, it seems such a stupid, redundant question, but I mean, how have you found this last year, you know, working, researching, because it's been so hard. A lot of us have been working from home, and previously we'd had campus networks to rely on and things like that. You know, how have you found it, really? Has it kind of really hampered your research, or is it just something you've, you know, got on with?
It's a multi-layered answer, really. Like, firstly, it's not been great.
No.
But fortunately, I didn't have any kind of field work to be worried about. Yeah. I had some kind of plans to maybe delve into some archives, but that was not central to my project. It would have been just kind of I would like to go and see what's in there and see what I can make of it. But when I designed this project, it was never with field work in mind. So that I feel relatively fortunate with, but I have found it very difficult. It's been interesting because with being in the middle of my second year, I did my upgrade/probationary panel last June.
Mm-hmm.
So going into lockdown, first lockdown, joyous days, last March, I felt like while it was really intimidating, I had the momentum of like, I need to work for this definitive, tangible thing.
Yeah.
And that kind of kept me going. But then the other side of summer, I suddenly slumped. And my supervisors were very much that's like very natural to feel like that. So it has hampered me, but not to disastrous extents. But I agree. Like I was always a fan of working from home, but I liked having the option of going to campus.
And, same, yeah.
You know, like I really miss libraries a lot. Mm. I guess my main challenge has been just not changing space enough for me.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes where I can just get on with it, but I think this was common for a lot of my friends by the end of last term in particular. The 2020 burnout was real.
Yeah.
By like early December, could I string a sentence together? Probably not. So I had a good break and now getting back into it, but we'll see. I think it's weird with this now a third lockdown, any sense of novelty is faded, and trying to keep like the excitement about work and, you know, kind of sitting in the same place every day, that is an ongoing slog, but we can do it. I'm confident.
It is. Yeah, that idea of changing place is really interesting, because it's now just like you turn 90 degrees and you've gone from your workspace to your home space, and it's like making, you know, the difference clear in your head between those two things. I was chatting to someone recently about the sanctity of Fridays and try to preserve what a Friday feels like in lockdown when you're working from home. I mean, weirdly, I've managed to keep the dream alive a little bit. So when Friday comes along, I know I the working week's done. I'm like, you know, I can still celebrate it a little bit, but Yeah, it is just all about, I think, keeping those boundaries between work and rest, I guess. But it's tough for us all, I think. Last question, really. I don't want to put you on the spot now, but obviously I'm hoping a lot of first year PhDs or even MA students will be listening to these or will hopefully get their hands on these eventually as gateways into what it's like doing a PhD. I mean, do you have any advice to these people that might be listening who are thinking of starting a PhD or in their first year on generally just how you go about your research, how to kind of keep going when you slump, which we all go through? Do you have any kind of final words or advice to any future PhDs?
I say,
and don't worry if you don't. I have put you on the spot.
It is a big question. Mm. So I think when approaching the like applying for a PhD, if you're thinking about doing so, mm-hmm. I think starting and maintaining an open dialogue with prospective supervisors is really important.
Yeah.
And don't be shy. I say this as a very socially awkward person, but it's like don't be shy. If you have a project in mind that's worth it, like it's already worth pursuing, so chat with people, even if nothing comes of it, chat with people, get to know people. I'd also say, like, in this time where it's really weird and we can't actually meet new people in person, trying to find communities, like obviously with USSO, trying mm-hmm. like, you know, setting up that online community, I think that's a really good way to go about it, because I only started being active on Twitter last year in the middle of lockdown, because I was like, I'm not music, like I was like, this is a way to connect mm-hmm. when I'm sat indoors. And this was before we'd figured out how to do online conferences and that becoming a more everyday thing. So I suggest kind of trying to find your network, find like-minded people. I'd also extend that to your first year PhDs in terms of that open dialogue with supervisors and with your research network about how you're doing at that stage as well. That's relevant to everyone, but it's just kind of, we're in really weird times. Mm. And by checking in as much as you can and keeping that open, I think that's a really good way and healthy way to maintain a bit of equilibrium during this really strange time. And another thing that I was going to say, and now I've forgotten. another thing I was going to say, it slipped my mind. I'm so sorry.
No, don't worry. Honestly, I can take it all out. It's absolutely fine.
Oh, no, I do remember, actually. This is, again, don't want to sound depressing because I find light in this, but I would say keep in mind of your internal and your intrinsic motivations. Again, this might be more for first year PhDs heading into the project. When the goalposts are constantly changing and in terms of academia disappearing, remembering what got you excited about this project in the first place is a nourishing place to find, and it might not be present or obvious every day, but just turning inward a bit can help to alleviate that. Because I came into this PhD thinking, I know the current state of higher education, and I have my eyes open, but nobody could have predicted what this last year would be like. No. So
I genuinely don't think I could have given better advice had I had all day to plan for it. So if that was off the cuff, you know, kudos. I just want to reiterate for anyone listening about the online communities, really. Twitter can be a productivity sink and it can have its vices, but it's been really good, especially this year, in bringing people together, getting people coming to Zoom events. You know, this podcast wouldn't have existed without Twitter and the people signing up for it, you know, yourself, etc. So yeah, it is a great place to meet people. Obviously, it's not the only thing out there, but I feel like I advertise it like it is. I'm like, oh, you didn't see that, it was on Twitter. You know, there are other ways to see things. But it is really good if you're struggling to strike up any kind of academic network, then Twitter is a great place to start. I should end really by thanking you for coming on and for talking about your research. It was really interesting to talk to you. Thank you for giving up your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. If anyone else would like to get in touch, you can email us at usso@bass, which is bass.ac.uk, and you can come on the podcast yourself to talk about your research. But other than that, thank you very much for listening.